Today on the 21st Show, ocean explorer Annie Crawley. Born and raised in Chicago, she attended the University of Illinois for journalism. Now she makes her living and her life underwater.
If we do a mind shift with humans and we actually are encouraging people to be learning to swim or snorkel, to explore the other 70% of our planet, like, it's amazing what opens up to us when we can actually enter water and not have a fear of it, but embrace it.
Crawley also has a new documentary that follows a group of people working to save sharks from illegal fishing in the Pacific Ocean. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Earth's oceans cover more than two-thirds of our planet's surface at an average depth of 2 miles. It's filled with life, more than anywhere else on Earth, but the vast, vast majority of that space is unknown to humanity. One of the people working to demystify the ocean for the rest of us is explorer Annie Crawley. She's a photographer, writer, and has earned the highest credential from PADI, the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, which is a master scuba diving instructor. Crawley is also a filmmaker, and her newest documentary is called The Island of the Shark, Guardians of Malpelo. Let's listen to the trailer.
Malpelo as a national park and fishing in a protected area, it's illegal.
What's happening in Malpelo is foreign vessels coming and pillaging a rich marine protected area that is the pride of Colombia.
The demand for shark fin soup is definitely fueling overfishing around the world.
We are doing our best effort using this catamaran, Silky, staying in this spot the most part of the year possible to protect what we can.
And that's the reason why what they do is heroic.
If we don't at least try to keep places like this safe, what's the purpose?
And that's why it's so important to protect these biodiversity hotspots.
Annie Crawley is originally from Chicago, earned a degree in journalism at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and she was in Urbana last week for a screening of the film. She's also one of two winners of this year's Illini Comeback Award, which is presented by the University of Illinois Alumni Association. While she was in town, Annie stopped by our studios to talk about her life and work. Annie Crawley, welcome to the 21st Show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
And a quick programming note. We taped this conversation last week, so no calls today, but you can always let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. All right, let's start with the film. Where exactly is the island of Malpelo?
Malpelo is 300 miles approximately off the coast, the Pacific side of Colombia. It's in an area of the world known as the Eastern Tropical Pacific Marine Corridor. And many people haven't heard of Malpelo, but they have heard of Galapagos or Cocos. And Galapagos is 5 million years old, but Malpelo is 20 million years old.
Wow. And it's the tip of a mountain, right? Of an underwater mountain?
It sure is. It is the tip. We only see about a mile above the surface, but it drops down thousands of feet.
I don't know if you're a Star Wars fan. It reminded me of that island where Luke Skywalker goes off to be on his own, where you can just sort of see vast oceans in every direction.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I was actually... Because I was staying on the boat I was with Biodiversity Conservation Colombia, I actually got onto the island with the Colombian Navy, who are stationed there, and I was able to climb all over the rock. And Malpelo means bald in Spanish, and so it's kind of like the bald island from the early explorers because it literally has no trees on it. Mm. There's nothing on it. And the birds and the crabs rule the island.
Yeah, it really looks otherworldly. So you mentioned the currents. Why is this place special for marine life?
So this place is the underwater mountain range that it is, with 11 islets in the main island. It is one of the places that three currents collide. And so when something is planktonic, it might drift in the open ocean before finding a place. But there's three predominant currents, but depending on what the wind and the weather patterns are doing, they have other currents that will come in during different seasons. And so one of the currents that changes right around now is the winds from Panama that blow the water across the surface, so upwelling can occur. And in the deep ocean, which is all around Malpelo, there's rich nutrients that come up towards the surface in these upwelling events.
So it's kind of like an animal Jane Byrne interchange in downtown Chicago, right, with all this traffic coming
absolutely,
in?
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And the other islands that I mentioned, Galapagos and Cocos, that make up this eastern tropical Pacific Marine Corridor, they're cleaning stations. So Malpelo is a great cleaning station for pelagic animals.
What does that mean, pelagic animals?
Pelagic are ocean-going. So think whale sharks and think hammerhead sharks and Galapagos sharks and swordfish, thresher sharks, all of these different animals that don't stay in one place, that move, what scientists believe, potentially they follow the Earth's magnetic field to these different volcanic mounds. So it's this great highway, underwater highway, that Malpelo is one big post that they all go and stop by.
Yeah. Well, which is one of the reasons it's attractive to fishermen, which we can get to in a moment. How did you first come to be aware of Malpelo?
So I think that Malpelo, Colombia, similar to Galapagos and Cocos for divers, is like the holy grail of the area that you would go to. But it was not necessarily an easily accessible area. Place because of the currents that we mentioned and the weather in the Pacific where wind can come up. And so there's no anchorage spot. So one of the reasons why Charles Darwin was able to explore the Galapagos was because you could anchor in so many different locations. In Malpelo, it's very hard to have moorings at Malpelo. So and the land is completely inaccessible.
And just to drive that home, since we're on radio, one of the things that I found so interesting in the film is it looks like the only way actually onto the island, you can't just sort of pull up on shore. There's like a metal bridge that extends out with this really frightening looking ladder that kind of droops down, and you have to climb up that to get onto the island itself.
Yes, and that is just so the Navy could get resupplied for the guys that are on the island because they have a permanent base there.
Who have done something to tick off their bosses to get assigned to Malpelo. But I digress. I digress.
I love it. It's great. I don't know. Sometimes it could be a reprise, too. If you like animals, it's like an amazing place to be.
Yeah.
At least that's how I look at it. Watching the birds.
Yeah.
They do have the largest population of Nazca booby birds. There's 100,000 birds on the island. And so the birds rule the roost.
Yeah, amazing. So I'm sorry, I distracted you. You were telling me about how it's the sort of holy grail for divers.
Yeah, so thanks for getting me back on point, Brian. So I wanted to go to Malpelo for years and years and years. Less than 400 tourists go there a year. And so because it's so underexploited and undervisited, it's a pretty tough place to get to. So a few years ago, I had the opportunity to jump on my friend Faith Orton's runs an expedition company called Blue Green Expeditions. And I went with her on a trip, and I'm actually leading a trip back there in October. A place that I could not resist because a company called Columbia Dive Adventures now has one of the safest operations that you could be on, that I felt comfortable and safe to go to Malpelo because it is such a dangerous island to travel to.
Yeah, and this company with, they have a boat that kind of becomes a character in the film. So you fall in love with the island. What do you learn about the overfishing, or really, I guess any fishing is overfishing in this place?
So, and Brian, just so you know, overfishing is the largest threat for our ocean today. And I hope everybody knows that they need to be eating sustainable seafood. And sustainable really easy means that we don't take more out of the water than what can reproduce. And so I think that many listeners might be aware of this problem with overfishing in our world ocean, but many people don't know the plight of what's going on with sharks right now. And so when I went here, because I'm educated and I've been a scuba instructor living around the world for more than 30 years, one of my goals in going to Malpelo was to see sharks because it is known as the island of the shark.
So you visit Malpelo as a tourist. While you're there, you make some connections with people and you learn about this effort, I think, to sort of ward off all this illegal fishing that's happening there. Tell me, what is this illegal fishing consist of?
So anywhere in the world that you have an island or a coast, people are going to want to fish. Mm. Like, this is just common. What's unique about Malpelo is that it's a Columbia National Park and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And so you would think that because it's a marine protected area that nobody would fish there. But this isn't the case, because if you are a fisherman and you could make it to this area and there's nobody patrolling the waters, you can illegally fish. Not unique to Malpelo. This can happen anywhere in our world ocean, anywhere along anybody's coast that you can illegally fish if it is not protected, and not protected by patrols.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, when we say fishing, I think those of us here in Illinois have this vision of having a pole and you cast out into the water and maybe you're looking for some bluegill or something like that. What is happening with the sharks when they are caught on? First, maybe we can describe the long lines. There's these.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So before we go there, we should just take a step back and say commercial fishing fleets are all over the world in international waters because there's no real rules on the sea when it's not part of a country's boundaries. And so these commercial fishing fleets will take tons, literally tons of fish from our world ocean. So when you have a place like Malpelo, which is an area that tuna are and migratory sharks go and swordfish and sailfish, when you have these different pelagic species, of course people are going to want to fish them if they can. And so what would happen is these pongas, which are small boats, would lay out long lines, which are set up by a buoy on either end, and they could be 1,000 feet long. And then hooks are set about every 6 feet between them, hanging down into the water. And they would attract anything from sharks to turtles to tuna. And when the fishermen set them, they'll set them miles away from Malpelo Island in an open ocean current, which will slowly make its way over the course of the night towards the island and catch anything that would go after the squid or whatever is baited on these hooks. This is illegal because it's a marine park, national park, and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So that is what makes it illegal. And so when I arrived as a tourist, besides my boat, that was the ecotourism boat called the Ferox, which is named after a deep water shark that that you could see when it comes into the shallow waters at certain times of the year. But there was another boat there called the Silky, which was named after silky sharks. And that boat, which is Erica Lopez's...
Which becomes the sort of the main subject of your film.
The yeah. main subject of the film. That boat, I learned when I was there as a tourist, is permanently stationed there and goes back to the mainland only to get its hull cleaned or to get refurbished or to get the maintenance that's necessary once a year. But besides that, because this boat is there, they do patrols around the island to prevent illegal fishing from happening at this amazing island.
And when we say fishing, I think, you know, again, it inspires this vision of maybe of somebody casting a line out. You describe these long lines. They're not even collecting the whole fish, at least in the case of the sharks, right? They're mm-hmm. often just taking them up, cutting off the fin, and sometimes, I guess, casting the rest away.
So, Brian, I can understand why you might think that
sure.
way.
Sure, yeah, maybe I misinterpreted.
Because,
yeah.
because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that's what people were doing.
Okay.
So illegal shark finning has been illegal in most countries now. So that shark finning is something that many of us fought to prevent in our future. And we've been successful
okay.
in illegal shark finning in many cases. Now, that probably does happen in different places, but in Colombia, they have very strict laws. And this is illegal in all waters of Colombia, shark fishing or shark finning. But now what fishermen are forced to do in many cases are to land the whole shark.
Hmm.
So shark fins are an issue, but the entire shark meat is also being trafficked around the world. And there are some shark fisheries out there that are sustainable, but many are what makes them illegal is when it is a species on the endangered species
sure.
list.
All right, I'm gonna interrupt you there. I'm sorry to do so. We're on a fixed clock on our program. We're going to take a break, and we will come back and talk more with Annie Crawley, an ocean explorer, a filmmaker, and an alum of the University of Illinois who was in town to receive an award last week. More to come after a break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with ocean explorer Annie Crawley. Originally from Illinois, she was in Urbana last week, received an award from the Alumni Association at the University of Illinois, where she had earned a degree in journalism. Back in 1990, she also screened her new film, which is called The Island of the Shark, Guardians of Malpelo. Because our show is on tape today, no calls, but you can let us know what you think. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, so before the break, we were talking about how the fishermen fishing illegally, what they're doing with the sharks. You say they now have to, it's not just about the fins anymore. They have to take in the whole shark. They take it in the boat. What happens next?
So many people don't realize this, but if you eat fish and chips in England or Australia or many countries, you might be eating shark.
Hmm.
So shark is a fish. It just has 5 gills, 6 gills, or 7 gills. More than 70% of oceanic, so pelagic sharks, have been fished from our ocean in the last 50 years. And they're being sold for different reasons. One of them is for their shark fins. So that is in still demand, the shark fins. So,
and you visit a market for that in Hong Kong, if I remember correctly?
So yeah, you have a great memory, Brian. I have visited many markets around the world that have sharks in the market for sale. It's really sad when you come across the illegally traded sharks, such as hammerhead sharks. When I went to the market, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, it is legal to sell shark fins for shark fin soup. And the experts believe that the two largest places that have shark fins being imported and then exported are Hong Kong and Singapore. And it is for a phenomenon that is known as shark fin soup in the Chinese culture, predominantly Chinese culture.
Yeah. So I want to share another clip from the film, if we may. And this is what you sort of go into what the animals experience, and not just the shark, but other types of ocean creatures that get caught up in this illegal fishing activity. Let's listen to that clip.
In fact, the animals suffer a lot. We don't want to see the reality for what it is, but it's cruelty. It's just another kind of torture to grab animals from the ocean, to mutilate them, and to let them die. The animals feel. They have pain. And the people need to know that they're not just objects without sensations.
So talk about what you saw with the animals in those moments.
Yeah, that was Erica Lopez, who is featured in the film. She's one of the brains behind Biodiversity Conservation Colombia. And, you know, the connection that divers have to animals and human beings have to animals are extraordinary. I will never forget this one time that we had turtles caught up in the nets, and the nets were wrapped around the turtle's neck, the turtle's flippers, everything. And the turtle was so long in this net, you could literally see where the line had cut through its skin and was male, like causing deformity in its flippers. And to watch Erica's crew so skillfully cut this animal out of the net and free it and see it swim free, it brings tears to all who see this scene. To see birds caught in this fishing line, to see sharks dying in the lines, it's heartbreaking. And it's cruelty. And so when you bear witness to scenes like this, you want to do everything in your power to help these animals. It's extraordinary. And I think that when Erica started doing this work many moons ago, she was a dive instructor working on liveaboard boats, much like myself in the way that I've worked around the world in liveaboard boats. And she did this every time she went to this island. There would be 17 boats there, 20 boats there. They'd be diving underwater with hundreds of sharks, and they'd surface, and they would see these illegal fishermen killing the sharks they were just diving with. And so to be able to tell the story about her work, now they do not have this problem around the island because her presence matters. It really is important to highlight when you have marine protected areas or areas of the ocean that we're trying to protect that you need people patrolling the water.
And it really is just, at least as shown in the film, they're not carrying rifles. They're not, you know, they don't have the authority of the military or the police necessarily themselves, although they work with national park authorities and the Navy, as you said. How do they actually keep the fishermen away with just their presence?
So I think that it was more challenging when they first went in the water because they didn't realize, like, the fishermen didn't realize, like, hey, this crew is going to kick you out and chase you and take your fishing line. So they are not allowed. They don't have jurisdiction. Only the Navy has jurisdiction to actually capture the boat, capture the crew, and they will prosecute crew members. But Erica's organization does not have that. All they have the authority to do is to take the fishing lines, to take the buoys, to take the people's equipment to prevent them from fishing in the future. And these fishermen are poor. You know, they don't.
I wondered about that because I see a shot where there's one scene in the film where it looks like they're just taking the lines out of these fishermen's boats. Like, don't those people ever fight back or resist? Or I'm surprised at that.
So in many places in the world, we hear about the fishermen fighting back. But these fishermen, they don't have that issue there because they know they are in the wrong place. Hmm. And the longer Erica's organization is around Malpelo, the fewer the boats are coming.
I want to come back to the film, but I want to talk a little bit about your background. So how does a girl from Chicago in one of those little 12-inch backyard plastic pools, as I saw in one photo, turn into a mermaid from the sea, right, as you once described yourself?
Yeah, I use that a lot. Like, I feel like the ocean is my home. I really do.
How did that come about?
So I think that when I was that little girl, I never had fear of water. I was on swim team. I feel like my mom tells stories that I was always able to like jump off a diving board at 2 years old and like somehow dog paddle to the side. And it just, we're water people. You know, we spend 10 months in in the womb of our mother and like in this fluid. And so for the first time, like, so I had no fear around water. I was a competent swimmer. And I came here to the University of Illinois imagining I would do a journalism degree. And as an elective my junior year, I took a photojournalism 101 class with at the communications department. And it literally changed my life, putting a camera in my hands. So, and
did you imagine yourself going into newspapers or did you know you wanted to do something involving water?
So I actually thought I was going to do broadcast journalism and water was far from my mind because, as you mentioned, you know, born and raised in Chicago, Lake Michigan was my ocean, you know, like Lake Michigan, the Great Lakes. That's what I swam in the summer. And so if you think about this, I gained the skills and the tools and the craft of photography under Brian Johnson. And my senior year, he actually just told me a story that he bootlegged Photoshop from Missouri and brought it back to us. And so I used, like, in my senior year, I used Photoshop version 1.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we have Mac labs all over campus for the students, but we had one Macintosh computer that I trained in. So once I learned the skills, I was ahead of photojournalists around the country because they were still doing print with the presses. And so the skills that I had, I was like a few years too early getting out and being able to do anything digitally. And so I saved my money for a year and went on a trip and thought I was going to go to Australia for 6 months. And I learned to scuba dive 2 weeks into my trip and didn't come home for 4 years.
4 years.
4 years. I literally, the first breath I had underwater, I looked at my scuba instructor just like I'm looking at you right now. And I was like, I could do your job, travel the world, become a scuba instructor, go to these faraway places. And so I lived a year in Australia, a year in New Zealand, and 2 years in Indonesia, traveling throughout the Indonesian archipelago as a scuba instructor, working on liveaboard boats. And
you have people in your life who said, like, when are you going to get a real job kind of thing?
My grandma said it till the day she died. And like, at the time, I don't want to age myself here, but we didn't have the internet at this point. And literally to communicate with my mother, it would take 6 weeks because it took 3 weeks for a letter to arrive at Postal Restaurant, and then it would take 3 weeks to go back. And so I think in Australia, you know, I had a very risque job as a deckhand and a chef on a boat. And after a while, my mom started sending me underwear in the mail because she was worried that after being gone so long that maybe I didn't have enough bathing suits and underwear. So every once in a while, I would get a package from my mom in Postal Restaurant that would be soft and squishy. And I was like, she did it again.
So how do you go from, so you've discovered this love of scuba diving. When do you bring photography and filmmaking into that?
So, you know, this was a few years before, you know, GoPros or mobile devices, you know, like now we're all filmmakers with a mobile device in our hands.
You were a one person crew on this film. I mean, with a lot of volunteer help.
Yeah.
But basically you are the, you know, the director, the cinematographer, the,
sound kind of recorders. All of it, which that's another story. But just so you know, in order to pursue underwater photography and filmmaking when I decided, after I returned home, I got pressured, get a real job. I actually worked at the Field Museum of Chicago, and I volunteered at the Shedd Aquarium.
Oh.
So after I moved back to Chicago, I was like, I need an ocean. I moved to California.
Mm.
And so I worked on boats. I had a professional job, and I was a part-time dive instructor and a part-time deckhand. And I went to a conference for sales that said, can you do more than you're doing today? People with vision prosper. You have to do things other people aren't doing in order to have the dreams. And it was all about sales.
This is like a guru type conference.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, harnessing okay. your human potential for sales.
Okay.
And what I ended up doing was I went right back to my office. I quit my job. I sold my car. I bought my underwater camera housings because they literally were the price of the car and my lighting systems.
Wow.
I took an undersea class at Brooks Institute of Photography with Ernie Brooks and Ralph Clevenger. And I went out 7 weeks later and I got a job as an underwater photographer and videographer on a liveaboard boat. And so that's how it all started. And then I worked on boats, like honing my skills as an underwater photographer and filmmaker.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. I was like, nothing was going to stop me because that was my true passion in life, was to take all of my skills and be able to share my ocean. The ocean gave me a voice with the skills that I learned from photography here at University of Illinois and then others I picked up along the way, and to be able to go out into the world and to capture the ocean in the way that I see it, not as a dark, scary place.
And one of the ways you do that, I mean, you do that with these films, you know, geared for adult audiences, but you also have a sort of, I don't know if you'd call it a sideline or a mainline, working with school children, yeah?
Yeah.
How did Ocean Annie come about?
So when I came back from living overseas, my girlfriend, her name is Kim Rizzo, she also went to school here at U of I. I had just published a book and DVD with Reader's Digest Children's Division, and they put me on a book tour and a speaking tour. And I went to the school in Chicago, and I spoke at Kim's children's school, and it was a great great auditorium. There were 1,000 students in there, and Kim's like, "Why do I have the kids call you?" And she said, "How about Ocean Annie?" And so I was known as Ocean Annie from that day forward because it was such a catchy, and that's what I did. I was underwater in the ocean, and Ocean Annie was born.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that my thought is always, if we educate children when they're young about the truth about the ocean, they will grow up loving the ocean because, you know, if you breathe in, Brian, just do this with me. Breathe in. Where does that breath come from, Brian? Where did you learn that the oxygen in that breath comes from when you grew up?
School, probably.
Yeah. But you learn that it comes from trees.
Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah,
that's what
gotcha.
We all learn. So when I was first starting my company, I was like, oh my gosh, oxygen comes from the phytoplankton in the ocean? I still remember coming across that fact back in like 2004, and it changed my life. And I was like, every breath we take, it does not matter where we are, connects us to the ocean. And I never forgot that. Every water drop of water we drink is part of the ocean water cycle. The food we eat, 3 billion people rely on the protein from the sea. So simple. And yet, we don't get ocean education in our school system.
Yeah.
And the media often misrepresents the ocean and sharks.
Let's talk about that when we come back from another break. We're talking with Annie Crawley, whose newest film is called The Island of the Shark, Guardians of Malpelo. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
Come on down to the bottom of the sea. Come on down here. There's room right next to me. I'm tired of getting even. Let's get on our baby and live life at the bottom of the sea. There's too many cars drinking too much gasoline. There's no good news on my TV screen. There's a hole up in the sky, so come on, baby, die. Live life at the bottom of the sea. Tried my best to be someone else, someone else as I tried my best to be someone else instead. Tried my best to be someone else as now there's nothing left of me.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with the ocean explorer Annie Crawley. Originally from Illinois, she is an alum of the University of Illinois, received an award last week in Urbana from the Alumni Association. She also screened her new film, The Island of the Shark, Guardians of Malpelo. Because our show is on tape today, no calls, but you can let us know what you thought. Our voicemail line is 217-300-2121. So we've got about 15 minutes left. I thought maybe we can, I titled this section of my notes Cosmic Ocean, right? They say the sea is cold, but the sea contains the hottest blood of all. You know, some people might say it's spiritual. Talk to me about how you experience the sort of deeper meaning of the ocean.
Wow, Brian, I think I need to write a book. Because, like, there's so many life's lessons that I've learned from the sea. One of them is, like, every 6 hours, there's a tidal change. There's a high tide, then a low tide, and a high, high tide, and a low, low tide. And it changes, like, literally every 6 hours. And so every day when I wake up in my land life, I feel like life is just a surface interval between my dives. I know that there's highs and lows in every single day that I'm going to have. And this is like the rhythm of the sea for me. And so not only has it taught me these physical things, but do you want to go on a dive? Should I take you on a dive?
Right now?
Yeah, let's go.
We'll go out to the Vermilion River or something?
Yeah. So when you go into the water, you wear all this equipment. SCUBA stands for Self-Contained Underwater Breathing Apparatus. We literally defy nature when we go underwater and breathe. And when
It's not a welcoming environment for our state of nature, so to speak, right?
Or we have to go against our nature go in the water. But when you say it's not a welcoming environment.
I could see you were triggered by that, yes.
Oh, my gosh, because that's exactly what we are up against, right?
Yeah.
People are afraid of water. Like, we don't teach our children to learn to swim so they can explore our world. We teach our children to swim so they don't drown.
I would say it's an environment that requires some significant adaptations from us in order to experience it safely.
I like that much better because, like, there are some, and I believe that in humans, like, there's great cause to teach them so they don't drown because it is the leading cause of death of children under four. So I don't want anybody in our audience to, like, be like, what? What are you saying, Ocean Annie? I am saying that if we do a mind shift with humans and we actually are encouraging people to be learning to swim or snorkel to explore the other 70% of our planet, like, it's amazing what opens up to us when we can actually enter water and not have a fear of it, but embrace it. And so that's where I was going with that. So because I didn't grow up with fears of water, it was easier for me to find this home with it. And there's a lot of science coming out. There's a group down in the Caribbean and in Florida that are using scuba diving with veterans suffering from PTSD. It is one of the most, I'd say that if you practice yoga or you have a meditation practice on land, the closest that I could feel as at one with water is in that kind of meditation state or a yoga state. When you slip in and you learn how to scuba dive, you're taught something that is called neutral buoyancy, which means you don't float, you don't sink, you're weightless in the water. And for astronauts who go to outer space, they have to learn to become excellent scuba divers. And their NASA has a huge pool to teach astronauts because it's the closest feeling that you would feel when you're in outer space. So if you could, like, just sitting here, Brian, you and I are in chairs. We feel the weight of gravity every day. When I learned to scuba dive and I perfected neutral buoyancy, it's zero gravity. It's floating. It's like the most incredible thing. And then you're zapped with this kaleidoscope of colors on coral reefs that, and you, in your opening, you shared life not only began in the ocean, but the ocean holds the majority of life on our planet. And so when you scuba dive, you literally do enter into another world, a world few dare to enter. I think less than 1% of our planet are scuba divers.
Yeah. And it, I'm so struck. There was another, I think this is from one of your other films, Blue Heart, Ocean Soul. There was just a quick shot of, I think it's called a chambered nautilus, which is this, people would recognize it if they saw it. It's kind of one of these spiral-shelled animals. It's got these tentacles coming out. It shoots the water out. You know, I'm fascinated with these creatures because, you know, their shell is mathematically interesting, right? That's the nerd in me. It's a logarithmic spiral. But they're not all that different from their Cambrian ancestors of 500 million years ago, right? We think, like, we go to, have to go to museums and we look at dinosaur skeletons, which, and we kind of imagine what they're like. You can actually time travel in the ocean, right, and see some of these ancient creatures.
I love that you brought this fact up. Not only do I love chambered nautilus, but like I've looked into the eye of a mother humpback whale, and it's life-changing because she has complete control over the interaction that you as a human have with her baby. And I could almost hear her sharing her baby with me saying, "This woman is safe. Go and say hello." And the baby humpback whale dances in front of me and makes some turns and is a newborn baby. And you could still see the wrinkles on the baby's skin from when it was in its mother's womb. Like having a magical experience with humpback whales who've been on the planet for 60 million years. And they're a success story because people hunted them almost to extinction. And they've had this great comeback. No pun intended to the comeback award I'm winning here, but they've had this great comeback in our world ocean. And when you think about sharks, sharks have lived through 5 mass extinctions, and they're having a very hard time living through the past 50 years on our planet. And when I look at a shark, this apex predator in the ocean, millions of years old, millions. We step back in time. Some of the coral reefs we're diving on, millions of years old. It's literally living history that we experience when we go underwater.
You had a column recently in a scuba diving magazine about that experience of being surrounded by sharks. And it was, I think it was somebody writing in to say they like the idea, but they're terrified of it, right? Another diver. What was that experience actually like for you, being in this environment? The sharks are feeding, right? There's like this food ball. I forget the term of what it's called.
Bait ball.
Thank you. Yes. And, you know, I think that's a lot of people's nightmares, right? Speaking of the way that you have issues with sometimes the way sharks and other animals are portrayed in the media. So,
yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for this question, Brian. It's like there's people have to understand that there's two different kinds of shark diving predominantly that anybody would do. One is when an operator would bait sharks in and put like dead fish and chum. They call it chum. They'll grind it up. They'll put it in the water. And that's to attract sharks to come. there's other kind of diving that you would do, that you go into the water in the shark's natural environment without any kind of chumming. I've done both kind of shark diving. Around Malpelo Island, there's a couple of months that this silky shark migration would happen. And there's what we call a bait ball, which is juvenile fish of a certain species, maybe jacks or sardines. There's big sardine runs off the coast of Africa. There's areas in our world ocean that bait balls will form, which are juvenile fish. And then tunas and silky sharks might target them. So when I was in Malpelo, the crew of the Silky and I would specifically go out to look for a bait ball to go into the water and dive with them. I know that might sound scary. What? I'm jumping into the water to dive with hundreds of sharks. Yes, that is the dream. That is what you are out looking for. You're watching for the booby birds, the Nazca booby birds, to dive into the water to show the human beings where where the fish are, so that we know that there would be sharks and tunas under there. So now we're in here. And if you only watched things like Shark Week or the scary videos that people put all over YouTube and in the media, you would not see what I saw. Literally, hundreds of sharks just cruising past very slowly, going to feed in the center of the bait ball. So as a diver, I'm not going to be stupid and get too close to the fish in the center of the bait ball. I am going to have lots of respect and stay away from the center of the bait ball, because I need to be safe and I don't want them to accidentally nip me. But all around me, I could dive with all of these sharks, and it's very different than any media portrays these animals. And so I always want to, again, there's chumming, trying to bait in dangerous sharks to come so that people can get a closer look. And then there's animals in their natural environment.
Near the end of the film, you say, public awareness drives corporate and policy changes. Sharks and all the animals in the ocean need your voice. What do you want people to use their voices to say?
I need people to do a little research. You can come in and talk to me. One-third of all shark species face extinction right now. I think we mentioned this already, but I'm just going to repeat it because it's like jaw-dropping. In the past 50 years, 70% of sharks and rays have been fished from our world ocean. Overfishing is the number one threat to not only sharks and rays, but to all the animals in the ocean. And I feel like the ocean is the great regulator on our planet. A healthy global economy is tied to a healthy global ocean. Transportation, everything from entertainment and like what we like to do. Like, ask anybody, where do they feel best? By water. We all want to be by water. And yet people have done, we are abusing our planet, and we really need to learn to live at one with our ocean because it regulates our planet.
I think that's as good a place as any to end our conversation. If people want to see your film, where can they find your work?
Right now we're in the process. We are entering it into film festivals, but we can do showings like we did this past week right here at University of Illinois. We are open to showing it through, if you have a group organization, if you want to see this film, contact us. We will get it into your group and your organization. We just put up a website, islandoftheshark.com. You could contact that through me.
Sure.
I'm very public. I'm very public. My email is published. And you will get me as long as I'm in the country with internet.
Yeah. All right. We will make sure to have a link to that at our website as well, 21stshow.org. We'll also post the trailer there if people want to check that out. Annie Crawley, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us today on the 21st Show.
It's been my pleasure, Brian. And I hope if there's one thing you're going to remember, every breath you take, and I know you take a lot of breaths, Brian, even though they're silent over there, every breath you take connects you to the ocean and us to one another.
Annie Crawley is an ocean explorer. Her film is called The Island of the Shark, Guardians of Malpelo. That's it for us today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.